You are listening to episode 379 of the GNU World Order. My name is Klaatu, and in this episode, we're going to be looking at some listener feedback. And we shall also be talking about Slackware 15.0, or the lack thereof. So let's get started. So first up is listener feedback. Apparently back in episode 38 of the 13th season, so that's a while ago now. So I've recently switched to just numbers. No seasons, just numbers. 379. So I took the number of seasons and some average number of episodes and calculated that I'm approximately at episode 379 now. But before that, I was using season numbers to indicate sort of when I would take a break, really. But now I just don't take a break, so there's no point in doing any sense of seasons. And back in season 13, episode 38, apparently I said, hey, send me stories of how you got into Linux, because I legitimately find this sort of thing very interesting. And I hope that eventually I will see stories shift in the pattern to something like, oh, I was raised on Linux, and just see where those stories go. Because there are very few stories, I think, now, or at least that I receive, of people being raised on Linux. Now, there are many stories that I can kind of detect starting to surface of people being essentially raised on Chromebook, which of course is running Linux, but you'd never know it from what I understand. I really need to get a Chromebook and actually experience that thing for myself. I've messed around with one or two briefly, but I've never owned one and tried to live on it. And I really should do that, especially now that most of my personal laptops have seemed to all have, I guess, died. The laptops are fine, but the batteries are sort of beyond recovery, apparently, and that's the replacement batteries, so I'm not really sure what's going on with those. But anyway, I'm curious as to how the origin stories of Linux users will shift as time continues. I mean, it might not, you know, it may have just stabilized on, well, I was raised primarily on this platform, dabbled in this platform, ended up a Linux user now, something like that, because that seems to be a pretty common one. But this one's from Izzy. And Izzy says, I'm just going to kind of read, I think probably most of this email. It is a little bit long, but it's a story. We might as well enjoy. Okay, so I'll skip over the intro. I know I just said I was going to read the whole thing, but the intro is just about how Izzy is a listener of this show, which I think we can all just take for granted at this point. So Izzy says, it begins probably when I was 4 years old, back before I knew what Linux or Unix even was, because my father taught me how to program x86 assembly by writing instructions on scratch paper and walking through them with me, as if we were playing the role of the instruction accumulator. He had done computers in college back when they were called minis, for only taking up the space of a wardrobe rather than an entire room, and wasn't too concerned with the operating system on it, but had to punch various holes into a paper tape to make the computer do what he wanted it to do. As I grew up, I always remembered these things, because it gave me an understanding of what programming was and how a computer really operated on the lowest levels. So I'm going to pause there. This is Klaatu again. I just want to kind of pause in reading this because I think that's a great story in itself. Fascinating to me how significant that must have been to get a lesson on analog programming at any point, really, in your life. I mean, remove age from the equation and just think about how the human brain works. Computers themselves are often not the best way to learn computing. It's weird because we have computers now, so the word computation and compute and that sort of, you know, the words from which computer were derived, they frequently, nowadays, they only mean something done on a digital computer. But really, that's not what the digital computing is, a recent thing. Computation is not. And I don't think I really understood that myself until I really started thinking about game design. And it was tabletop gaming that kind of made me realize that these fun games that you play at home with your friends, especially the co-op ones where you're all working toward a goal and you're working against the game itself, that was a process that was a form of computation. And it wasn't until I took a little course, a little math class at work. They were offering 3D matrix mathematics for, for within the film studio, for people who hadn't had that in school. They offered it at work as sort of a lunch and learn type of thing. Which, by the way, I did not learn, nor did I lunch. I lunched before the class, took the class, did not learn the math, tried, could not, so maybe next time. But it wasn't until I had mathematical functions explained to me as literally a function. I never really understood how even like math sort of related to computation, bizarrely enough. So what I'm trying to say is I think there's a lot of value in the analog lessons around computing that shouldn't be discounted. And I think we do. We ignore it a lot, I think. I have a friend who teaches young children. And one of the first things she does in her programming classes with you know, the intro course with little tiny children is analog computing, where you give the kids some note cards, and the note cards have symbols on them, like an arrow and a stop sign and things like that. And the kids program a quote-unquote robot, which is actually a human, a teacher, and they program the teacher with these instructions on what to do. So, for instance, there might be a simple goal, like, okay, we'll get this quote-unquote robot across the room without bumping into the wall and have them hit a certain spot. And so, you know, you put the arrow down and then the stop sign, and that makes the robot go forward and then stop. Or maybe an arrow, you know, three steps and then stop, whatever. And then you introduce something a little bit more complex, like here's an obstacle. Now we've got a chair in the way. So how do we get the robot to go up to the chair, but not bump into the chair, and then around the chair, and then into the target spot, or whatever. I'm kind of making it up, but you get the idea. And when I, you know, when I saw that lesson, I just thought, well, that's brilliant. Like, that's a great way of teaching computing without ever turning on a screen. No screen time, but all computing, an entire computing lesson without having to, I don't know, learn how to type or learn how to use a mouse or just to be by being dazzled by pixels on screen. So very, very cool. Okay, back to Izzy's email. Says, fast forward a bit. When I was 9, my sister gave me my first computer I ever owned for my birthday, and it was, frankly, a piece of e-waste. I was very excited. Finally, a machine that I could make do whatever I wanted. Very quickly, I began messing with the Windows XP install that was installed on it, trying to customize it and optimize it however I could. I changed the boot logo. I edited registry files. I changed the theming and the layout, and I tried uninstalling all the bloat I could off of it. I decided that I wanted to start programming in a real language that people were currently using at the time. The one that stood out was Ruby. It was a pain in the absolute boot sector to get it installed. And once I had finally unpacked the libraries, ran the installer, and accessed the command prompt with a working environment, it broke on me. I was livid. The computer was supposed to do what I told it to do, not the other way around. Okay, this is Plat 2 again. I'll press pause again. This is kind of interesting to me because I feel like this is a common thread in this kind of story that certainly I share with Izzy and probably other people share with Izzy, just because, like, again, this is just kind of where we are at in computer development, right? You get introduced to one OS, and then you discover Linux a little bit later. And one of those steps in that discovery of, or right before you discover Linux, it seems to be, and this is something that I've heard a lot of, is it's sort of hacking to whatever degree you can hack on the OS that came with your computer to kind of fix it. And you can take the word fix to mean a lot of different things. I mean, it can be, well, literally to fix, like it's broken and it will not operate unless I go in and intervene. Or it could just be, well, it doesn't operate the way that I want it to operate, so I'm going to try to hack on it as much as I can to get it sort of aligned with what I actually want a computer to do. And that does seem to usually fall flat. It seems to fail. And that's kind of one of the things that drives us to Linux. It's kind of interesting. Okay, so next paragraph. As I looked for a way to start on actually writing applications, I discovered that a lot of people were recommending this thing called Linux based on something called Unix. Long story short, he starts hearing about Ubuntu, and from Ubuntu, apparently people are saying Ubuntu was a little bit bloated at the time. This is around 2006 or so. And so he stumbles upon something called Linux Mint. I didn't really know what beta software or development version meant at the time, so I thought it was fine that I was running a Linux distro literally the first day it was released on bare metal with no Linux experience. I never really was woken up from that illusion, as I just thought that opening up a terminal and issuing modprobe this and chown that was the easy and beginner-friendly way to do things. Through that process, I learned a lot about the structure of the Linux kernel as well as the Linux directory structure. I was on Linux Mint for about 5 years or so until I bought my own computer with my own money at age 16. When I got the computer pre-installed with Windows, unfortunately, I decided to graduate, quote-unquote, to Ubuntu, as I was having a lot of hardware compatibility issues that Ubuntu was apparently the distro to deal with. Since I had Windows installed on the computer already, I decided to use this nifty application called Wubi, that's W-U-B-I, which, if my memory serves, was supposed to load the Windows install into RAM and repartition the disk to install Ubuntu alongside Windows. Starting from Ubuntu 13.10, I distro hopped for many years, trying everything from DSL to Core Linux to not quite installing OpenBSD to Gentoo to Void Linux to Solus to, you get the point. I've tried more distros I could get my hands on, but all of them have had problems that I couldn't install packages into their package manager without doing some weird process to package them. This year, however, I decided to try a distro I hadn't tried yet, Slackware. And it was like a breath of fresh air. Just the simple fact that I can package software by compiling it is like I finally have the control over my system I have been craving since I was 9 years old with the first computer. I still am in the middle of my Linux journey, but that's how it started. And that's Izzy's story. I think it's a really good one. Lots of common little tidbits in there that I feel like a lot of people share when they're talking about how they found Linux. I do want to kind of highlight maybe here a little bit that, you know, he mentioned specifically ModProbe and Chown and things like that having been a result of him stumbling into a distribution sort of at the right time, except the wrong time. I mean, like the first day of its release, that's kind of the wrong time. And yet I feel like a lot of us have that same kind of experience as well. Sort of like finding the wrong thing for you as a new user that then ends up to be exactly the right thing. I mean, for me, for whatever reason, I started out with Linux just weeks before Slackware 12. I think it was 12.1 was released. It might have been, was there a 12.2? I don't know, but whatever it is, I started out on the 1. And so for a couple of weeks, I just spent my first couple of weeks on Linux proper, recompiling a kernel because there was a missing Wi-Fi. There was a Wi-Fi card in my laptop that just didn't exist in the kernel yet. So recompiling the kernel without really any knowledge still of what a kernel was exactly. I mean, I think by that time, I guess I kind of did know what a kernel was, but it was pretty hazy. And that's how I started, was compiling the kernel in a year where, you know, people were pretty much just, it was an assumption that people didn't compile kernels anymore. That was not really a thing that you did, but there I was compiling a kernel. And I was perfectly happy to do it, to be honest. I wasn't frustrated. I was learning a lot. I knew I was learning a lot. I knew that the lesson was difficult, but I knew that it was valuable. And looking back, that's still true today. And it's funny, too, because as Linux users, I feel like we do spend a lot of time and energy thinking of ways to prevent that sort of thing from ever happening to other users. And while I do believe that that is a noble cause, I do believe that we should always be striving to make the experience on Linux better. That's the ideal. We want technology to be smooth and helpful and so on. But at the same time, I think sometimes we overthink it as well. I'm not saying everyone needs to have hard lessons when they first are introduced to Linux by any means. I'm all for someone having a smooth, worry-free, just fall into Linux and not even notice. I love that idea. I've known people to do it. I've known several people. Some people I've introduced to Linux and other people I've met and they're like, oh yeah, I run this thing called Ubuntu. I don't know if you know of it. You know, it's just like, wait, what? So yes, I've met these people, I have talked to them, they exist, they've had really smooth introductions to Linux one way or the other, and that is great. At the same time, getting a computer is never, it's always subject to something, right? I mean, you might think, well, you know, if someone buys this computer off the shelf, then they'll never have a problem. That's such a disgrace. Well, I've worked computer support desks before. I know that that's not true. And if you've worked computer support desks, I know that you know that that's not true. It just doesn't happen that way. There's no guarantees in life with Linux or any operating system. I guess what I'm saying is we mustn't overthink this too much. We don't need to be overly critical of that introductory Linux experience, because fact of the matter is, these are still computers. There's a lot of variables here. There's a lot of hardware out there. There's new hardware every day. And no one's telling the software people what hardware is coming out. And the software people have to play catch up and so on. It's just, it's nonstop. So that's fine. Don't overthink it. Don't panic if when you're introducing Linux to someone, or if you're being introduced to Linux yourself, there are going to be moments of triumph, and there are going to be moments of confusion. And that's normal, and it's fine. Let's move on now to, actually, I was going to talk about Slackware, but I feel like let's talk about PowerTop first, and then I'll talk about Slackware in general. So PowerTop is an application for Linux used to diagnose issues related to power consumption and power management. This is an application put out by Intel specifically for Linux, and it is geared towards systems running on a battery. So my Slackware machine is not running on battery. It is a desktop machine. So the PowerTop is not very useful for it. PowerTop is also, as I said, put out by Intel. And while it doesn't require Intel, from what I understand, it can still work with just ACPI enumeration, I guess. But I gather that because it's by Intel and there are a couple of Intel-specific things within it, I think it's probably optimal to be used with Intel. My Slackware system is not an Intel system, it is an AMD system. So that's two strikes against PowerTop on Slack, on my Slackware machine. So my point is that I'm trying to get to here is that I did not actually use PowerTop on my Slackware system for the research for this show. I instead used it on my ThinkPad, which I have from work, and it is an Intel system running Red Hat Enterprise Linux 8.2. So that's what I've tested PowerTop on, simply because, again, the system I'm running Slackware on is not battery powered. That's the primary reason. I would have been up for it if it had been an AMD system on battery or something like that, but not being on battery at all just kind of makes PowerTop not as useful. The workflow for PowerTop is relatively simple. I'll tell you what you're probably going to do first, and then I'll tell you what you should do. So PowerTop, if you're like me, you will just first type in the command, see what happens. And if you do that, you get sort of a thing that looks maybe superficially a little bit like top, and you might make that association because it's called PowerTop. There's top, there's HTOP, kind of thinks they're the same thing maybe. It also kind of superficially works or looks like maybe something like PS or some kind of an analysis tool like that. And I guess it's a little bit like HTOP, but really it's very specific towards the efficiency of your system. So the first thing that you'd want to do if you were going to try this out is unplug your power cable from your laptop. You want to be running on battery for this. And then instead of just typing PowerTop, what you'll actually want to do is I'm going to type in history so I can remember what I did. Okay, here we go. So the first thing that you're going to do is you're going to do a PowerTop dash dash calibrate. And what that does is it kind of takes note, it runs a little test cycle, and figures out the levels of power consumption on your device. Like what processes running on your device in its typical idle, I don't know if idle is the correct term, but in its typical state, what is using up the power and in what way and so on. And that takes a while. That'll take a good, I don't know, 5-10 minutes. And it'll seem a little bit weird because your screen blacks out and then it comes back on and then it blacks out again later. So yeah, you'll get confused and you will not be sure of what it's doing or why it's doing what it is doing. You just let it do its thing. Within a couple of minutes, couple of minutes, you get your prompt back. But it doesn't necessarily tell you a whole lot from there. It doesn't tell you what you're meant to do next. All you know is that you've calibrated something. And it's not really very clear about what you're supposed to do next, which I think would be a criticism that I would have of this little application. I mean, that's what the user manual is for, I guess, is the counter argument to that. And this user manual, honestly, is quite good at explaining a lot of stuff. I mean, it's a lot more about power consumption than I knew. For instance, I didn't know that there was a thing called C states. Package C states, often referred to as PC states or PCX, happen when all the platform cores agree to enter a specific C state, and so on. So, I mean, this is interesting stuff, and you can determine whether you're using CPU freak or Intel P state by doing cat on / sys devices system CPU CPU 0, for instance, CPU freak freq as in frequency / scaling _ driver, and it'll tell you like what you're using. And you can find Intel P state controls at cd or / sys / devices / system / CPU / Intel _ P state. So I mean, it's a really good manual that, you know, if you're really, you really want to know how to use PowerTop, I guess this would be the place to go. But for me, I didn't really want to get too deep into power management necessarily. So I just kind of sort of followed along with what they got to eventually. I think I would have appreciated at the beginning of the manual, maybe like step one, step two, step three, you're done. You're efficient now. I think that would have been kind of nice. Although I can definitely respect them wanting you to actually read the text as well. I'm sure they worked very hard on this manual. Oh, it's 10-page manual. So it's, yeah, definitely an easy read. Okay. So the next thing after you calibrate, generally speaking, from what I'm understanding, is that you're going to do a PowerTop --auto-tune. And you'll do these as with a sudo prefix. You need administrative privileges for these. So sudo PowerTop --calibrate, sudo PowerTop --auto-tune, and that's it. You're kind of done. Now, there's a caveat here, and that is that PowerTop --auto-tune only lasts until you know, for your current session. If you were to reboot your system, then all of those PowerTop performance enhancements go away. So you're going to have to add stuff to your .-rc in order to retain these settings. How do you know what to add to your .-rc? I have not found a really, really elegant way of doing this. I've looked, but I have not found like the switch in PowerTop that says sort of, you know, just export the stuff that I need for persistent tuning of my system. And I feel like it really ought to be, I feel like that ought to be a thing that you can get from PowerTop, but like I say, in the 10 pages of the user manual, I was not able to find that. So it may well not exist, or it might just be in one of its options that I'm just not connecting sort of to that purpose. For instance, there is a --csv and a --html option that outputs a bunch of information either as a CSV file or an HTML file, but I don't see anywhere in there that it will give me what I want, like the options that I want to make PowerTop persistent across all sessions. And according to the user manual, as far as I can tell, the way that they are recommending you do this is that you enter interactive mode and toggle on and off the good and the bad setting. And when you do that, when you toggle it off or back on, you see the command that it's running in order to get it to a good state. So interactive mode is that thing that you see when you first type PowerTop. If you just type PowerTop into a terminal, you get that interactive mode that looks superficially like top or htop. Across the top of the screen is a tab bar. It looks like a menu bar, but it's actually a tab bar. And so if you hit tab and you go over to tunables, you get a list. You get a list. Now, everything in my list right now on my screen is set to good because I've already run calibrate and auto-tune. When I first did this, the very first time, when I went to tunables, there were a bunch of bad things in there. They were marked bad. But after I've calibrated and auto-tuned, everything is set to good. How did they get to good? Well, you select one of the items, and now there's a screen full of items. So I guess what I really would want to do if I was going to actually make this a thing, and this is honestly what I intend to do, because I would like to try this out. Who's going to say no to better battery time? So I'm gonna try it out, but what I'll have to do is reboot this machine at some point, run power talk, take note of the bad ones, and mark those as bad somewhere, like on a sheet of paper or something, and then do the calibration, do the auto-tune, and then go through and just select the ones that were bad and are now good. Select those, toggle that on or off, and see what setting it had to run in order to get there. Now, I'm not sure because I haven't done it. I haven't done an A-B test setup yet, but I believe the ones that didn't have to be adjusted from bad to good, when you look at them, the command, it just tells you that there was no command. So I feel like that may be an indication. Either way, I would like some confirmation that I will have to do further testing on that for myself. But in practice, what you'll do is you'll go to PowerTop Interactive Mode, tab over to Tunables, and then look at something that is set to good now, and it tells you, for instance, here's Bluetooth device interface status. It is set to good now. I'm assuming that previously it was set to bad, because when I toggle it back to bad, it tells me that in order to get it to good, I could run /usr/sbin/hciconfig /HCI0 /up /redirect dev null ampersand. And that would apparently make this much more efficient. Now, I'm surprised that that's all it takes to get this to be efficient, because to me that sounds like we're just turning on the HCI control, which is something that I'm more or less familiar with because I had a USB keyboard that I used to use with my Pocket Chip, which is a little embedded system, little personal, it's like a Raspberry Pi with a screen on top of it, basically. So I'm surprised that what PowerTop is telling me is that all I have to do in order to make that good is turn on HCI control. That seems puzzling to me. But there's other stuff too. Auto suspend for USB device, XHCI host controller, USB 3. It says echo on redirect, quote, sysbus USB devices, USB 3 /power/control. So once again, this is essentially enabling auto suspend for a USB device, which I'm assuming was not on before. And that makes sense to me, because if I don't have auto suspend active, then when I plug in a USB device into my battery powered computer, then I'm going to assume that it's going to be on whether that USB device is actively being used or not, which does seem bad for a battery. So that one makes a lot of sense to me. And these commands that I'm seeing by toggling a good back to bad and then back to good again. If I enter that command into, they say just put it into your .bashrc. If I enter that into bashrc, then suddenly I'll be properly efficient on this device. Now here's the thing that I haven't quite thought through yet as well. This PowerTop is telling me what's best for battery power, but if I'm not on battery power, then do I want all these settings to be active? Will I see a performance hit due to this or not? So yeah, I almost feel kind of like PowerTop or the PowerTop optimizations would be things that I want to become active when I switch over to battery and then ignore when I go back on to power. But I don't see a way, again, just with PowerTop, I don't see a way to make that occur. I don't see I don't see an easy way to sort of script this. So I don't know. I'm going to say clearly, because what I'm looking at is their official user guide, their manual. And I mean, just the way that the tool works, too. It's obviously not something that you activate and have running in the background that detects when you're on battery and when you're off, when you're on AC, and it's switching optimizations depending on what you're doing. You know, it's obviously something, it's an analysis tool that tells you, hey, you're on battery power right now, here's what's not efficient. Here are the fixes that you can implement to make it more efficient. Getting that to be like any kind of dynamic sort of on-demand service is up to someone else, I think. That's the work for analysis has been done with PowerTop. Utilizing that is up to whatever else. And who knows, maybe that's what some of these backends are using, like in KDE system settings, when you go there and you go to energy power management. Maybe that uses PowerTop in part. I don't know. It's just worth mentioning, I guess, that PowerTop isn't the thing that you're going to turn on and then have your computer suddenly run more efficiently. It's It's an analysis tool, and they'll be set up for you to do after you run it, if you want it to be a thing that happens. And then it, certainly, if you want it to happen, if you want that thing to happen every time you just go on battery power, and then to stop doing the thing when you go back onto power, then you'll have to implement a completely different solution. Although, interestingly, in the previous episode, I was talking about PM util, and that's the power management utility scripts that tell you if you're on AC power or not. That's kind of useful, possibly, for this for power top. There's some connecting of parts that you might be able to do to come up with an interesting solution. And certainly, I do intend to probably do some of that on this laptop now that I know PowerTop exists. Speaking of power and top, it's time to top up your cup of coffee and renew your power. So let's go do that, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit about state of Slackware. Okay, I've got my cup of coffee. I hope you have your cup of coffee. So we're going to talk about the sustainability or the longevity of Slackware. Slackware 14.2 was released in July 1st, actually, of 2016, which, as I say it out loud, sounds simultaneously like it was ages ago and like it was just yesterday. And I say it sounds like it's ages ago because it's like 2016. It's 2020 now. We're in the next decade block. That feels significant somehow, even though it really isn't. But it sounds like a short, sort of brief period of time, because if you think about long-term support in the Linux world, 5 years is kind of the gold standard. By gold standard, I just kind of mean it's the default. I don't know that it's the gold standard because of any reason. It's just that's probably someone's marketing idea. 5 years was easy to sell, easier to sell than 4 years. I don't know, whatever. But Ubuntu long-term support is 5 years, I'm pretty sure. RHEL long-term support is 5 years, I'm pretty sure. OpenSUSE, I think, starts at 5 and then goes up to 8 or possibly 10, something like that. I haven't looked at it recently. I know they have quite an impressive long-term support option. So those distributions that sort of declare long-term support, 5 years is pretty typical. And so Slackware having this release cycle, of course, we don't call it long-term support here. I mean, technically everything back to, I think, Slackware 8 dot something is still supported with security updates. But this release cycle for the exciting new upgrade, OS upgrade, being, let's say, 4 going on 5 years, let's even extend it and say 5 and some change, 6 years, whatever. That's about right. Now, it does feel sometimes a little bit tenuous because of the outside world. It keeps sort of shifting. You stay secure. You stay safe and sound on your sort of little Slackware island, but the rest of the world around you is still moving, and you see that in different places in practice. So, for instance, the first time I think we probably really saw it was Python. I mean, everyone saw it with Python. But when Slackware 14.2 released, 2.7.5 or whatever it was the correct choice. That was the sensible and correct choice for what Python to ship with your OS. 3 had, I don't know how long 3 had been out, probably quite a while by that point, but the migration of libraries and utilities to 3 was not complete by 2016. Not everyone had shifted to 3. So it just made sense for everyone to ship 2.7. But last year, 2 became deprecated. It is end of life now. So 3 is it. That's the only, supported option that you have. So here's Slackware. If you install it today from the DVD, then Python 2 is the thing that you have. Whether that seems like a sensible default to you now or not, it's just that offset. It's just inconvenient timing. Oh, by the way, the thing on your disk is now deprecated in real life. Too bad. So now there are a couple of ways around that, but I won't I won't necessarily talk about that yet. First, I want to talk about other places that you see it. And so I think when you have a release, the first clue that you get that the world is moving on without you, as it were, is that kind of high-level stuff, like the Python incompatibilities, or not even incompatibilities, but just like, oh, everyone seems to be releasing for Python 3 now, and no one's using 2.7, and then eventually, oh yeah, 2.7 got deprecated. So you see that, and that's an easy fix, because you just think, well, okay, cool, I'll install Python 3, done, everything's fine, you've got everything you need again. But the farther away from that release date you get in this sort of Big Bang-like explosion, you know, as you're traveling farther away from that point of origin, the further down the stack those incompatibilities start to go. So, you know, at some point you might find an application that wants not only Python 3 but also Qt 5, and you've got Qt 4 by default. Well, that's okay, you can install Qt 5. Now, that's a pretty big stack. There's a lot to think about there, but it's still a stack. It's still pretty self-contained. But then you start seeing things like CMake incompatibilities, because CMake needs, or this version of this application needs C++ 17 support, and your CMake is 3.5, and C17 support isn't available until 3.18 or something like that. So you know you have to upgrade that. And then maybe some other application needs some extra C headers that you don't have. You've got glib something, and you need glib something else. Not glib C, I'm just talking about glib, the thing with all the extra functions in it. Yeah, it starts to get closer and closer to that sort of core, that core set of utilities upon which a bunch of other things are built. And if you start swapping those things out, then you run the risk of, at best, introducing uncertainty into your system. And at worst, actually breaking something, like your computer won't boot kind of breaking, or your desktop won't launch, that kind of breakage. Now, that can be pretty troubling, and you really have to ask at that point, well, how important is this thing? And I had to ask myself that just the other day. I was going to install Synth V1, and I've discovered that it is the releases have been such that the release available in Slack builds, which is the official unofficial extras repository for Slack work, slackbuilds.org, offers 0.9.12, I think it is, and that's been phased off of the download page in like SourceForge. And the available releases, or the immediately available releases, are 16, 17, and 18, or something like that. And if you download 0.9.18, you'll find that there is indeed some kind of incompatibility. Something, I forget whether it is the CMake thing. I know I upgraded CMake for something. CMake or something like that, and you have to resolve that, or you don't get it. No, you know what it was? It was a Qt incompatibility. It wanted 5.9, I think, and I've only got 5.7. Which, I mean, I could upgrade Qt, but then that becomes problematic potentially. So, you know, you just kind of have to ask yourself, well, is that worth it? And you know, there's infinite flexibility in Linux, so technically speaking, you can make all of this go away. You can solve all of these problems, but what's not infinite, obviously, is your time. And you have to. There's a trade-off. You have to say, okay, well, I wanted the fancy new thing over here, but it's going to cost me a weekend. Is that worth it, or is it not really? Is not that important. And you make that trade-off. And the larger trade-off really that you're making is that long-term support. Do you want the OS itself to be stable and the same for 5 years, or do you want to go at a shorter release cycle and start upgrading and sort of tracking along with the rest of the world? And I guess that's what I am kind of hinting at here, is that there is a thing called Slackware Current. And if you're not running Slackware Current, then it's not that hard to get started with Slackware Current. It's not something that I would do haphazardly. It is something I would definitely consider carefully, think about, kind of plan my upgrade path and so on. But essentially, it is a matter of switching over your repository, your Slack package mirror, to the current mirror instead of a 14.2 mirror. And then when you run Slack package update, you get all the changes, you get notification of all the changes that have happened since 14.2 was released, and since, let's see, at the time of this recording, since November 1st. That's the most recent entry in the change log at the time of this recording. So you get a notification of all these changes, of how 14.2 has changed since 2016 up to 2020. And then you can tell it, if you want, to upgrade all, upgrade-all, and it will. It will upgrade everything on your computer. It's a big change from 2016 to 2020, I can tell you that. And when you're finished, you can reboot. I think you have to reboot. I assume you would have to reboot. Then you have a completely new system installed on your computer. It's a really impressive and exciting activity. And a lot of people swear by Current. Or if they don't swear by it, they live happily with it. I did for a while on a computer. I don't remember if I did it on my primary system or not. I think I might have for a while. I don't really do that anymore, but it is something that I've done in the past. And I think about it sometimes, like on a spare computer, like maybe do that. I don't do it on a production system either way, or what I consider a production system. I mean, my production systems these days aren't actually production systems. There's nothing that's actually mission critical, because there is no mission. But there's what I'm comfortable with, and Current seems a little bit too risky for me. Is Current as risky as, say, I don't know, running Arch or Fedora even? I'm not sure. When I was running it, I would say no. I would say that Current was fine. It's not like it automatically upgrades you whenever Pat Volkerding makes a change. You know, you get to make that call of how closely you track Current. And so if you monitor the change log and kind of make upgrades as you see fit, and when you're comfortable to make those upgrades, then I think, generally speaking, everything runs pretty much as expected. And this keeps you sort of tracking the rest of the world, at least to some degree. Now, again, like, I mean, when I say tracking, I mean, you know, 5.4.74 is the kernel, as of this recording, that's the kernel that Pat just added to Slackware Current. Now, I'm going to type in uname-av on the system that I'm running, which is 14.2, and I'm running 5.9.1, which is the latest kernel release as of this recording. The latest stable kernel release as of this recording. So it's current, but it's still conservative, which, again, 5-year support, that's kind of the feel that you want. You want to know that even when you're being current, you're lagging way behind using tested, tried and true, tested kind of technology. So I would say that about Current. I would say that is very much the tradition of Slackware Current, is that it lags behind just enough to make you feel comfortable with, even though you're on the cutting edge, quote unquote, of Slackware, you're still being a very conservative kind of upgrader. So that's one option. Current is one option. As I said, it's not the one that I do typically, just because it is it typically, especially lately, it does involve some of the systems that I use Slackware heavily for. So for instance, the ALSA and the Pulse audio, you start messing around with that and you actually do start affecting my workflow in a very real kind of everyday way, because I do a lot of recording. I'm a podcaster, go figure. So that's the sort of thing that I don't like messing around with. If Slackware Current was more about, I don't know, low level, I don't know, maybe if it was leaning into the container thing, and that's where it was doing all of its experimentation, I might actually be into that. That might be interesting to track along with. But for my audio and my video and stuff like that, not so eager to jump on board with something that kind of messes around with that. So I don't do Current. What I've been doing traditionally is, or historically, is stay on 14.2, or stay on the current release, like that's, or the, rather, the latest release. That's simply what I generally do. If I'm feeling adventurous, which apparently I was this weekend, if I'm feeling adventurous, then I might upgrade some major component. So this weekend, for whatever reason, I decided to upgrade my KDE desktop from 4 to 5, and it didn't go well. Did not go well, as well as I would have expected. So Alien Bob, a contributor to Slackware, has a repository called K-Town, and in K-Town, he very kindly builds and releases for everyone Slackware packages of KDE, the KDE desktop, which, I mean, it's a huge undertaking. I'm only assuming, and I hope, that he has it all scripted and automated so that he's not actually working too hard on it, because it's a major undertaking. I tried building KDE once, and it didn't go well. That did not work out at all for me. But he does it, and he pushes the packages to his server, and you can go get those packages, download them to your computer, and upgrade your KDE install. Now, that's a huge, huge change. It's a major, major change, because KDE has a lot going on with it. So when you do that upgrade, there is a heck of a lot that gets changed on your system. And that did not work for me. So what I ended up doing was uninstalling 5, going back to 4, and then just getting unhappy with the whole situation and reinstalled all of Slackware, because I figured it was probably time to kind of check up with sort of how current Slackware media was anyway, because I felt like there's probably been packages that have fallen out of favor and that have come up that hasn't been accounted for. So I just figured it was a good time for an audit anyway. So I blew everything away except my home directory, obviously, and maybe not obviously, but that's what I did. And then reinstalled everything, and it went swimmingly. So I did this from the Slackware DVD itself. So that's the 14.2, the thing that you get, you know, back when it was released, back in 2016. In fact, this DVD is from 2016. Popped it into my drive, installed it, and then I had a 14.2, stock 14.2 system from which I then upgraded everything just within the 14.2 branch, so that everything was kind of up to date, you know, like the kernel and the some of the lower level libraries that had been upgraded for whatever reason by Pat himself. I installed a more modern kernel just because I could, and then set about installing all of the Slackware media packages from slackbuilds.org, which went well, except for a couple of things here and there. Like I say, some things have just kind of phased out, other things have changed or moved around on the internet and so on. So it was good that I did that, I think, for my own rationale for like my own project. But it kind of highlighted sort of both the complexity and simplicity of keeping a release kind of up to speed with the rest of the world. And it kind of displayed how you can have a rather up-to-date system without going to current, as long as you're willing to make either a couple of sacrifices or work a little bit extra to stay on that latest release. I can't necessarily say which one is the sort of the smarter choice, but I can say, again, for me, for my purposes, I feel like a good way of splitting that difference between, okay, well, here's exactly what was released in 2016. Here's what's going to be released eventually in current. That middle ground is this sort of system that gets, well, patched a lot, right? You're patching your system a lot. And I think if I hadn't decided to just blow Slackware away and reinstall clean, that is exactly what I had. I had the latest release plus all the patches that Pat had sent through, plus any customization that I did, and that's fine. And if I kept on that trajectory, it would have been fine until current became the new release. Because of circumstances, I didn't do that, and I cleanly installed a fresh thing of Slackware, and I feel like, generally speaking, that would have been fine too, but there would have been adjustments to make, I think. I think there would have been things to account for, which is why I was glad that I did it, because if someone out there wants to build up a Slackware media system at this point, then they're going to find some unpleasant surprises, like, oh, well, this package here doesn't build. I don't know why, because I'm not good at this sort of thing, and I'm just following these instructions by this guy named Klaatu. Why isn't it working? Well, I know why it's not working, and now I can go amend the documentation. But I feel like it's important to remember that even as one thing stays the same, the rest of the world is progressing, and you do have to take that into account. And so one of the ways that you can do that is you can install the stuff that works for you and keep it more or less at a stable state. That gets complex if you get into Slackware at a point when those things aren't stable anymore, because now you're having to backtrack. It's kind of like if you're running Fedora or RHEL and you realize, oh, I need this package that only Fedora has, but not the Fedora of today, it's the Fedora of 3 versions ago. So I'll go raid their software repository. In other words, I guess I wish there was a way to tie software releases to dates more better. You know what I mean? Like, if I know that Slackware was released in 2016, and if we're saying, well, you got 3 good years of being, for all intents and purposes, current or modern, then I know that any package I find on the internet, any source code, any source bundle I find on the internet up to 2019 should basically be safe to install. Like, that would be a good sort of earmark. And anything from, like, 2020 on, well, they probably shifted over to this and that and this technology and that technology, and now it has to, you have to kind of readjust, and you have to just be prepared that if you get anything that's ticked over on that 2020 side, then now you're going to have to rebuild some low level library in order to account for that or whatever. I kind of wish that there was a better way to adjust according to year, such that it's not the version of the thing that actually matters on a zoomed out level. You don't really care about the version. You just care about kind of like the underlying platform that it was built for. Now, if it sounds like I'm starting to hint toward a talk about Flatpak again, I'm afraid I am. But this is also applicable to like AppImage as well, because both AppImage and Flatpak acknowledge that, you know, when building across platforms, or rather when building across distributions, the important thing is to build for a certain point in time. For AppImage, they tend to recommend to build your AppImages on CentOS, you know, last version, whatever, you know, whatever that was. So it used to be 6, now it's 7, because CentOS is on 8 now. So build it on 7. That way you know that you're catching all those distributions that were kind of concurrent with 7, which, by the way, has a 5-year long-term support. That'll work. Flatpak doesn't really have to worry about it, you have to think about it in that way, because they have their platform releases that they have released. And when you install a Flatpak, it knows what platform it was built for, so it pulls that in if it's not already on your system. Really, really, really good principle to remember. And it turns out it's useful, just as useful for Slackware. So I am currently running Slackware 14.2, but with an updated kernel, with an updated glib, not glibc, just glib, updated, CMake, updated Qt 5. 5.7, I think. So anything beyond 5.7, you know, if it requires 5.9 or whatever, that's not going to build for me. And frankly, I'm okay with that. Could I download Qt 5.9 and install, you know, and make things work? Yes, I could do that. Not going to. It's just not that important to me. But so there's a little bit of manual maintenance, which, again, if you're running Slackware, you're probably okay with that as a concept. I don't know that you need to be, but if you want to hit that middle ground, then that's where you would want to be. So the weak point in this equation, I think, in the way that Slackware is sort of set up right now, at least, the weak point is for the person who does want the latest things, but doesn't want to have to work for it. Now, I think you could probably say, well, that's not a weak point, because that's what Slackware Current could be. But I think, to be fair, I don't think Slackware Current sort of presents itself as a thing that you're supposed to be doing. It is very much kind of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge kind of system, where you get in if you know about it and know how to activate it. It's not something that's really promoted as a thing. And to compare that, for instance, just go to opensuse.org. You go to opensuse.org, and they tell you right there on the page that you have Tumbleweed and you have Leap, and that's what you're presented with. And that is exactly what I've just described. I mean, you can have Tumbleweed for for it's their rolling release. It is everything that you have access to stuff as it is released. And then Leap is the one that is released. It has a release, and then it is frozen. CentOS has done the same thing, CentOS.org. You have CentOS Linux and CentOS Stream. And the Stream is the one that gets you everything as it is released. CentOS Linux is the one that you get a snapshot of a certain thing in a certain time, and that is where you are. And that's CentOS. I mean, that's kind of a big deal in a way. I mean, the way that they apparently see themselves for the Stream, CentOS Stream, is kind of this rolling release distro that is ahead of RHEL, Red Hat Enterprise Linux, but not so far ahead that it is equal to Fedora. So it's kind of that, again, that kind of middle ground between the snapshot and the thing that the developers are committing every night. There's that sort of middle ground to get you sort of somewhere in between. So it's an interesting shift, I think, in operating system development. And I'm aware that I'm probably quite late in even vocalizing this. I mean, I know Arch has been around forever. Fedora has been around forever. I mean, these are things that are famously sort of cutting edge, dangerously cutting edge, and the antithesis to the sort of snapshot release concept. And I think it's most interesting to me to find that Slackware kind of does actually fit that model after all, a little bit. As conservative as current is, it is still current. And as old as 14.2 is, it can be made more current or not, depending on your requirements. So those are the options anyway. You've got the snapshot release where you install it from a DVD. Maybe you get one or two things from Slack build, and that's it. That's all you ever do. That's kind of your ecosystem. And I imagine you could run on that for quite some time and be very happy. I mean, I know you can. And then there's that middle ground where you take the 14.2 and you start modifying it here and there. And that's probably the most of all of these. That's actually, to be fair, probably the most dangerous, because you could, if you're doing it manually, you can screw things up. Whereas current has a lot of people testing it, and generally, as long as you don't track it every night, it's a pretty safe place to be. I know quite a few people. A friend of mine, McNally, follows current pretty regularly, from what he's told me, and he says it's fine. He doesn't seem to have any problem with it. So those are your options. As I say, the current one is just a matter of taking Slack. Your Slack package mirror in /etc/slack package/mirrors, and just setting it to a current mirror instead of a 14.2 mirror, and you're fine. So anyway, I'm not advising you to do one or the other. I'm simply laying out the landscape. I'm just describing what we have to work with, and it's a pretty nice toolkit. I mean, it really is. It's a lot to work with, very, very flexible, and it is, as usual, you can make it exactly what you need it to be. That's the beauty of Slackware. It's the beauty of Linux. So I'm not recommending one over the other. I'm just reporting. So make your choice. Choose your poison and get into it. Thanks for listening. I will talk to you next time. Cast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Augcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @klaatu@mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course, you can visit my various websites, gnuworldorder.info and slackermedia.info. I will see you next time.
of side 1. To continue, turn the cassette over.